From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air.
Well, I heard you that good to rockin' tonight.
On this Labor Day edition of Fresh Air, Elvis Presley, The Early Years. We talk with Peter Guralnick, who's written Volume 1 of a two-part biography of Elvis. Songwriters Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller tell us the story behind Hound Dog, and we hear from DJ Fontana, who was the drummer on Hound Dog and many other Elvis hits. And in the area of Elvis spin-offs, rock historian Ed Ward tells us about some women rockers who hope to be the next Elvis, and linguist Jeff Nunberg listens to Elvis songs sung in Latin. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
There's good to rockin' tonight.
First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The top Bosnian Serb general says he won't withdraw his heavy weapons from around Sarajevo. General Ratko Mladic has rejected a NATO ultimatum to move his big guns or face renewed airstrikes. The NATO deadline is 1 hour from now. Mladic's letter declaring his intention was sent to the UN commander in the Bosnian region. This contradicts an earlier letter from Bosnian Serb political leaders who indicated a willingness to comply with UN demands. NPR's Andy Bowers is in Sarajevo. He says although the deadline is close, it's not clear just when airstrikes might recommence.
They're not saying when exactly they would start NATO airstrikes again. One thing to note here also is that the UN's Rapid Reaction Force, which has heavy artillery up on Mount Igman nearby Sarajevo, has continued to respond on the occasions that the Serbs have sent a shell into Sarajevo or have started to do so. That part of the operation has not been halted. It's simply the airstrikes, and it's really up to the commanders when those commence. We don't have a hard and fast deadline for that.
Bosnian Serb Commander Mladic says he cannot order the heavy guns withdrawn without a popular referendum and approval by the Bosnian Serb parliament. First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton says attending the UN Women's Conference in China is the right choice. The First Lady's leading the U.S. delegation, and she's getting heavy criticism from U.S. conservatives. They say she should have stayed home, given human rights abuses by the Chinese Communist government. Mrs. Clinton points out that the U.S. delegation includes Democrats and Republicans, conservatives and liberals. She says they speak with one voice when trying to advance causes of women. In Algeria, security forces defused a half-ton car bomb in a heavily populated town near the capital. NPR's Suni Khalid has more from Cairo.
The explosives were packed inside a van parked in the district of Boufarik, about 16 miles south of the capital, Algiers. Several local people became suspicious about the van and then notified police. A bomb squad discovered the explosives and neutralized the device without injury. The latest discovery comes on the heels of several car bombings in the past few days. Last week, a suicide car bombing near a police headquarters in Algiers killed 9 people, including 3 policemen, and injured 109 others. No group has claimed responsibility for the bombings, but authorities suspect the Armed Islamic Group, one of several rebel groups attempting to overthrow Algeria's military-backed regime. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
Kashmiri rebels are claiming responsibility for 2 bombings today in the Indian city of Srinagar. The bombs went off near 2 banks where Indian military officers were collecting payrolls. The Indian government says at least 10 people were killed, but witnesses say there were more. The attacks are the latest by rebels fighting for the independence of the Kashmir state. This is NPR. Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo has invited the rebel Zapatista National Liberation Army to take part in national talks on political reform. It's the first time the Mexican government has agreed to widen discussion with the rebels beyond questions of Indian rights and land ownership. The peace talks are due to resume this week. Morris Walsh filed this report for the BBC from Mexico City.
A new round of peace talks between the Mexican government and the Zapatista guerrillas is scheduled to begin on Tuesday. But last week, the Zapatista leader, Subcomandante Marcos, said the process was exhausted after months of fruitless talks between the two delegations. In an apparent attempt to break the deadlock, President Zedillo said he wants to bring the Zapatistas into national talks on political reform. This would give the rebels an opportunity to press one of their main arguments, that Mexico's authoritarian political system, ruled by the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, for the last 66 years, must change before there is social peace. Since he took office last December, President Zedillo has said democratic reform is one of his priorities.
Chris Walsh reporting. Former President George Bush is in Vietnam for a historic but unofficial visit. He's the first American ex-president to meet with Vietnamese leaders since the war ended in 1975. His visit comes less than a month after the United States and Vietnam opened embassies in each other's capitals. Park rangers in San Antonio are mystified. They've been finding homemade mines in the San Antonio River. Four of the mines, or debris from them, have turned up in the last 10 days, bobbing just below the surface. Investigators say they don't know if the mines are intended to strike river barges. There's no indication of who's putting them in the river. The latest device is a plastic soda bottle filled with a colorless liquid and tied to a piece of metal to hold it under the water. The mine intended apparently more to startle people than it was to cause damage. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame has finally found a home in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum, which opened Friday in Cleveland. One of the first inductees into the Hall of Fame was, of course, Elvis Presley. Today we pay tribute to him. The book, Last Train to Memphis, which just came out in paperback, may be the definitive story of Elvis's early years. It's the first in a projected 2-volume biography of Elvis, written by Peter Guralnick, the author of previous books about the blues, country music, and southern soul music. Guralnick says he wants to rescue Elvis from his detractors, his admirers, and the dreary bondage of myth. I spoke with Guralnick last October when Last Train to Memphis was published in hardcover. We started with the story of Elvis's first recording. When he was 18, hoping to get discovered, he went to the fledgling Sun Studio in Memphis to take advantage of their service that let you make your own record for $3.98 plus tax. This is the recording he made.
Evening shadows make me blue, when each weary day is through, how I long to be with you, my happiness. Every day I ring, dreaming of your tender kiss, always thinking how I miss my happiness. Men, years it seems have gone by since we shared our dreams, but I hold you again. There'll be no blue memories then.
Elvis recorded this hoping that it would give him an in at Sun Records. He wanted this to be his audition. So what did Sam Phillips, the founder of Sun Records, have to say when he heard what Elvis had done?
Pretty much nothing. Not at that time. I mean, I think on Elvis's part, it was an unrealistic hope. And what he got out of it, ultimately, was he got a two-sided acetate. The other side was, "That's When My Heartaches Begin." And he went home with it, and he played it himself. His parents played it. I'm sure everyone marveled at it. He played it for his friends. And he stored it away, eventually. What this probably led to was a revamping of his thinking, and all through the fall of 53, he continued, at least as Marion Kiesker remembers it, and Marion Kiesker was Sam Phillips' assistant, the office manager at Sun Records. And Marion recalls him coming in over the fall, and Sam also has memories of Elvis over the succeeding months. He came back in again in January of 54, made another acetate, and again nothing happened. And it wasn't until the spring of 54, I think until May of 54, that he finally got a call from Sam Phillips. And this came about as a result of both Marion Kiesker and Sam Phillips noting about Elvis that he was a good ballad singer and that maybe someday, and I'm sure this was also promoted by Elvis's return visits to the studio just to check in, see what was going on, but each of them had noted that Elvis was a good ballad singer And eventually he got a ballad called Without You, which he had picked up at the Tennessee State Prison over in Nashville. He didn't have a singer for it, and he called Elvis back in.
And so Elvis comes in because Phillips thinks that he has the right voice to record this ballad, and then Phillips doesn't like the way Elvis sings it.
That's right. And again, the interesting thing in terms of this whole issue of cultural theft is that the ballad that he recorded does not resemble in the least anything to do with black music, the African-American tradition. It may very well be a black singer who is singing it, but it could as easily be Dennis Day as the Ink Spots. And Elvis's attempts at it haven't been preserved, at least not as far as anyone knows. But it was obvious that they didn't get anywhere with this ballad. Sam evidently asked Elvis to try other songs. Elvis probably threw in every song he knew, which were mostly, but what he sang for Sam that day was almost entirely ballads. It would be Dean Martin's songs by Dean Martin, songs by Billy Eckstein, songs by the Ink Spots, but nothing whatsoever resembling rock and roll. And I think at the end of the day, there was a feeling of great frustration on Elvis's part. I mean, just terrible disappointment. And on Sam's part, there remained the kernel of the idea that this kid is different. He has a different sound. There may be something. What is there? You know, there's something there that can be gotten. And out of that, Sam put him together with Scotty Moore and Bill Black, and said, "Why don't you guys try something with him and see what happens?"
Scotty Moore, the guitarist, and Bill Black, the bass player.
That's right. Yeah.
So the three of them come back into the studio. And they ended up, instead of doing more ballads, they end up putting out a single that on one side has Blue Moon of Kentucky, which was a Bill Monroe tune, something out of bluegrass, and on the other side had That's All Right, a kind of rhythm and blues thing by Arthur Crudup. How did they end up with that selection, considering Elvis had been pegged as a ballad singer?
I think nobody was more surprised than Sam Phillips, Scotty Moore, or Bill Black. I mean, they came to this out of sheer desperation, I think, on Elvis's part. Elvis met Scotty. He went over to Scotty Moore's house on a Sunday, Sunday, July 4th, as far as I can determine. On Monday night, they went into the studio. They really just ran through a bunch of songs. They ran through the same kinds of songs that Elvis had done for Sam Phillips in the studio previously. On Monday night, they went into the studio, and you can hear some of the early attempts, like Harbor Lights or I Love You Because, which were just pure ballads. Eventually, they were brought out years later by RCA. But it was evident by everyone's account that the session was completely falling apart. They were no more on the verge of success than Elvis had been in his initial tryout. And they took a break, and I think it was just in a moment of sheer desperation that Elvis, everybody's drinking Cokes, and all of a sudden Elvis just starts flailing away on the guitar and singing That's All Right, Mama. When Elvis started playing That's All Right, Scotty and Bill fell in and started playing along, and I'm sure it was very ragged, but Sam Phillips opened up the control room door, and he said, "What are you guys doing?" And they said, "I don't know." And Sam said, "Well, whatever it is, let's back up and do it again."
Well, let's hear Elvis doing That's All Right.
Well, that's all right, Mama. That's all right for you. That's all right, Mama. Just any way you do it, that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. Any way you do. Well, Mama, she done told me. Papa done told me too. Son, that guy you fooling with, she ain't no good to you, but that's all right. That's all right. That's all right, Mama. Anyway, do.
It's Elvis Presley. My guest is Peter Guralnick, and his first of a two-part biography of Elvis Presley has just been released. It's called Last Train to Memphis. I guess you really have to give Sam Phillips credit for hearing what it was that made Elvis Elvis and not trying to fashion him into, somebody else's mold.
I think you have to give Sam Phillips enormous credit, not only for hearing, which is unique enough in itself, but for waiting.
Right,
for
right.
For not imposing himself on Elvis or on Elvis's style. This is really at least a two-tiered story, and probably more, because I think that Scotty and Bill had a great deal to contribute as well. But the thing is that Elvis was a person of such broad musical intelligence. He was someone of so many different musical interests. Marion Kiesker described how, on the first acetate, he went through 12 different styles in the course of one song. And I think you can hear him straining on some of the ballads that came out from those sun years. You just hear all these different voices and all these different gropings, in a sense, towards his own style. It was with That's All Right and Blue Moon of Kentucky, and then rolling on from there, you can hear someone discovering his own voice instantly. It's mm-hmm. almost as if it came to him instantly, and it was his voice. It was not the voice that Sam Phillips, there was no imposition in it. Mm-hmm. It was not Sam Phillips saying, hey, you should record a blues, but it was Sam Phillips waiting until that moment happened and then saying, that's it.
My guest is Peter Guralnick, author of a biography of Elvis Presley called Last Train to Memphis. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Peter Guralnick, the author of Last Train to Memphis, The Rise of Elvis Presley. In your book, you really treat Sam Phillips with enormous respect.
Yeah, I think it's one of those remarkable accidents of history that a person of such unique talent as Elvis should be thrown in with a person of such equally unique gifts as Sam Phillips. I mean, you have really the meeting of in Sam Phillips, you have someone who's as close to a genius as anyone I've ever met, and you have his a person of just unswerving vision and dedication to the music. What's also interesting about the Elvis Presley story is that when Colonel Parker comes into the story, you have a person of an entirely different kind of genius, but you have someone who, in terms of entrepreneurship, in terms of marketing, in terms of is as focused, as driven, and as single-minded as Sam Phillips was with respect to the music, and you had an enormous conflict.
Colonel Tom Parker had already entered the record world by the time he took over Elvis's contract. What did he see in Elvis? What did he want Elvis for?
I think he saw him as a phenomenon that was happening. He witnessed it. He set up a tour early in 55, and he saw the phenomenon happening on that tour. He saw Elvis taking the show from his star act, Hank Snow, whom he was managing exclusively and with whom he was in a booking agency partnership. He saw the thing building. And just as Sam Phillips had recognized the potential in terms of music, just as Sam Phillips had recognized the musical potential, Tom Parker recognized not just the sales potential, but the phenomenological potential. I mean, this thing was happening in a way that nothing had happened before, and it was happening with a speed that nothing had ever happened before, at least not in his experience and not in most people's experience. So from late spring of 55, he was clearly in the picture in terms of trying to wrest the management contract from Bob Neal and get the recording contract from Sam Phillips.
When Parker brought Elvis to RCA, how did that change his sound?
It changed his sound a great deal, only because nobody at RCA knew how to record him. The Colonel had no interest in music. I don't mean to say he had no interest in music. I think he was a passionate advocate of Elvis in every way. And if Elvis had recorded in Lithuanian, the Colonel would have sought the best way to record Lithuanian language records. But it's a mistake to see him as influencing Elvis's sound per se. What really influenced Elvis's sound was that Sam Phillips had evolved a method, and he had also worked out a way of pushing Elvis, not pushing is perhaps the wrong word, but of either inspiring Elvis or creating a climate in which Elvis could find his own voice and find his own style. At RCA, Steve Scholes was the person who essentially signed Elvis to RCA. Steve Scholes was almost he was a person who noted down the times. He was an A&R person. He suggested songs, but most of the songs he suggested Elvis found inappropriate. And he didn't have either a great deal creatively to contribute to Elvis, nor did he know Elvis, which was a very important point for somebody who sought reassurance. I mean, Elvis sought reassurance. He was looking for some form of approbation, and Steve Scholes didn't have it to give.
Peter, I'd like you to choose one of the RCA sessions that Elvis recorded that you think shows something about what changed for him at RCA when Sam Phillips wasn't around to help Elvis keep discovering his Elvisness.
I think a good example, and it doesn't have anything to do with the technical side, is his recording of Blue Suede Shoes. The reason that he recorded it was because it was such a huge hit for Carl Perkins. RCA was nervous that they had signed the wrong artist by getting Elvis rather than Carl, and probably this was Steve Scholes' idea. But the thing is, if you listen to the recording that Elvis did, which I loved at the time and continue to love, it never gets the groove. He never gets past the point. It's taken too fast. It's evident, as Elvis later said, that he simply didn't feel that he could beat Carl Perkins' version. But more than that, it just never grooves in on that inner, that you listen, for example, on the Million Dollar Quartet, and you hear him talking about Jackie Wilson's version of Don't Be Cruel, and he sings it over and over and over and over again. And I think that's how he heard a song, was just by he would hone in on it. And with Blue Suede Shoes, it stopped several steps too short.
Why don't we hear Blue Suede Shoes?
Great.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, do anything that you want to do, but not, honey, lay off them shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoe. Let's go, cat!
My guest is Peter Guralnick, and he's a new biography of Elvis Presley. Last Train to Memphis has just been published. It's the first of his two-part biography of Elvis. When Elvis started producing himself at RCA after his early sessions there, what changed for him?
What changed, I think, was that he was driving the session. It was at the July 2nd, 1956 session that produced Hound Dog and Don't Be Cruel that he really took over the reins for the first time altogether. And the thing was that I think that it was at this point that he was giving directions, may be the wrong word, but he was leading the musicians. He was suggesting where he wanted to go. He was suggesting voicings. He was saying, when Steve Scholes said at the end of Take 18 or something that, I think we've got it now, Elvis said, no, let's keep going, and he went on for 31 takes. He allowed his own artistic vision to take precedence for the first time, and essentially, here he was at 21, he was running his own sessions.
Why don't we listen to Don't Be Cruel?
Okay.
You think this is a good record for him?
I think that for the first time he was, for the first time at RCA, he was singing in his own voice. I think that it's very different than the Sun records he made. It's much more of a pop record. But this was the direction in which he had been looking to evolve from the moment he first stepped into a studio. So that while it may not be as much to my taste as Mystery Train, say, it's a moment in which he's discovered his own Elvis voice once again.
You know I can be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who
heart, it's true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love, baby, it's just you I'm thinking of. Don't stop the hate.
Your book ends with Elvis in the army, boarding the ship that's going to take him overseas to Germany. And there's a lot of press and fans and so on there. In fact, let me play a little bit of a press conference that I held right before he set sail.
Here at the Brooklyn POE, where Elvis Presley, Private Elvis Presley of the United States Army, is due to embark for Germany today. And let me tell you just a little of what the hubbub is like here. We've been, as I say, waiting for the past 2 hours for Presley to come in. There was some delay with his train. Now Elvis moves over and is going to sit down behind the desk. The microphones will be brought in. More pictures will be taken. Elvis apparently enjoying the whole thing very much. He's been in smiles since he walked into the room.
I'll starve to death, sir.
Is there a question back there?
I beg your pardon, sir.
What do you think you might do? Maybe we have that gentleman.
If rock and roll music were to die out, which I don't think it will, I would try something else. I would probably try... I would really probably go in for the movies then. I would try to make it as an actor, which is very tough because you got a lot of competition.
Peter, would you describe to us a little bit about what that day was like for Elvis?
It's a perfect example of the dutiful Elvis carrying out his sense of behaving correctly in public while feeling utterly forlorn and lost inside. I think there was a sense on his part, his mother had just died. Here he was on display. He's feeling as if as he has told many of his close friends, he feels as if his career is gone at the moment of greatest triumph. The most terrible things have happened to him. And yet here he is on stage in front of all these people, all these adults, who really don't particularly wish him well, presenting a smiling, dutiful exterior image, saying all the things that he should say, never breaking his composure, never breaking, and expressing his patriotism and a sense of duty. It's a remarkable. It's not simply a remarkable performance. I mean, it expresses some of his very best qualities, and it also expresses some of the qualities which, in a sense, crippled him.
Peter Guralnick is the author of Last Train to Memphis, which just came out in paperback. He's now at work on the second volume of his biography of Elvis Presley. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I've been traveling over mountains, even through the valleys too. I've been traveling in day, I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. Ever since I read your letter, where you said you loved me true, I've been traveling night and day, I've been running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. When I read your loving letter, then my heart began to sing. There were many miles between us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our tribute to Elvis. The songwriting team of Lieber and Stoller tell us the story behind Hound Dog, and the drummer on that record, DJ Fontana, remembers his years backing Elvis. Also, the women who tried to be Elvis, and Elvis in Latin.
Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. There are conflicting reports as to whether the Bosnian Serbs will meet UN demands and pull their heavy guns out from around Sarajevo. A Bosnian Serb leader says his side has accepted a UN-NATO demand to pull back the weapons after receiving guarantees the Bosnian government won't attack after the withdrawal. But the Bosnian Serb's top general has rejected an ultimatum to pull the heavy weapons from around the city. The United Nations says the rejection letter from Bosnian Serb leader Ratko Mladic is unacceptable and does not meet UN demands. A UN spokesman says serious consideration is now being given to the resumption of NATO airstrikes. United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali sent a message to the plenary meeting of the UN Women's Conference in Beijing today. He praised the Chinese government for being a gracious and cooperative host. The message comes after days of complaints by delegates to the Companion Non-Governmental Forum. Attendees are upset over stringent Chinese security, surveillance, and restrictions. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports from Beijing.
Boutros Boutros-Ghali sent his regrets for being too ill to speak in person at the opening session of the Women's Conference. Instead, his remarks praising China were read by UN Undersecretary General Ismat Kitani.
You are hosts to a conference that seeks to unite, not divide. You have invested in it great care of detail. You have invited the world to your capital, and the world is grateful.
Many delegates to the non-governmental forum, being held in tandem with the UN conference, say otherwise. They've complained about Chinese security police restricting and harassing delegates. But Boutros-Ghali seemed to be making a larger point. He said that China should see its decision to host this conference as a symbol of its emerging role as an engaged and responsible member of the world community. I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Beijing.
Labor Secretary Robert Reich says American workers are failing to keep up with the country's advancing economy. He says company profits are up, but paychecks are not.
The only people who are doing very well these days are people with specialized skills or professionals, highly paid, top CEOs and top managers. They continue to do extremely well, but your worker in the middle, in fact, most American workers, are not seeing a very rosy Labor Day in terms of their paychecks.
Hurricane Luis is closing in on the eastern Caribbean. The storm is less than 150 miles from the Leeward Islands. Top sustained winds are clocked at 140 miles per hour. Officials in Antigua have cut power, fearing the storm will rip down wires and start fires. In Puerto Rico, forecasters are warning there could be worse damage there than was done by Hurricane Hugo, which struck 6 years ago. Hugo was the most devastating storm in the Caribbean in half a century. This is NPR. The International Red Cross reports the Tamil Tigers plan to release dozens of civilian hostages they hold. The Tigers hijacked a passenger ferry last week, taking more than 100 people captive. Rhys Ehrlich reports from Colombo, Sri Lanka.
The Tamil Tigers hijacked the civilian ferry and used it as a decoy to attack government patrol boats. According to the Red Cross, the Tigers say most of the 136 civilians still held on board will be released after they go to Jaffna, the northern city controlled by the rebels. Kumar Panambalam, a prominent attorney in Colombo who supports the Tigers, explains.
If civilians have not taken active sides, then of course they will release them.
The Tigers are fighting to form an independent Tamil state in Sri Lanka and have frequently engaged in armed actions that killed or injured civilians. For National Public Radio, I'm Rhys Ehrlich in Colombo, Sri Lanka.
Jerusalem residents are celebrating a birthday for the city. It's been 3,000 years since Jerusalem was captured by King David. 17 months of celebration began with ceremonies at newly reconstructed archaeological sites outside the old city. Not everyone is celebrating. Palestinian groups and the European Union have boycotted. They say the celebration ignores Palestinian claims to East Jerusalem and disregards the city's Muslim and Christian heritage. Republican Senator and presidential candidate Bob Dole has begun his fall campaign with a speech to the American Legion. He says that government and political elites are undermining American values. Dole says such elites are responsible for things like the national history standards, which were funded by the government and sharply criticized. Dole says standards slighted America's best moments while focusing on negatives, like the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. Dole says schools must teach Western tradition and American greatness. He says bilingual education has no place in schools. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross with the second part of our tribute to Elvis. His hits Hound Dog and Jailhouse Rock were written by the songwriting team of Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. They were both inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987. In 1991, they told me the story behind Hound Dog. Lieber and Stoller wrote the song in 1953 for Big Mama Thornton.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Well, Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The record we've been listening to, Big Mama Thornton's recording of Hound Dog, was your first major hit as songwriters and producers. You wrote the song for her. What was it about her that led to this song?
Well, Mike and I were invited to Johnny Otis's rehearsal studio to listen to and look at some of his artists. Big Mama was one of them. And she was really formidable. She was scary looking. She was big, and she must have weighed about, anywhere from 275 to 350. And she had this really gutty, guttural, growling sound in her voice. And the both of us fell in love with her.
Well, how did you come up with this song, though?
Well, Mike was driving, and I was banging on the roof of the car, and I was trying to come up with something nasty that would be, at the same time, playable, that wouldn't be censored, you know? And the closest I could get to what I was thinking was, you ain't nothing but a hound dog.
So you were thinking four-letter word, epithet, and what
right.
you came up with hound dog.
Right, which sort of, you know, made it felt right, and it seemed like it would be passable.
Mike, let me ask you how you think Elvis handled the song differently from Big Mama Thornton.
How he handled it differently? Yeah. Well, he handled it very differently. He didn't sing it in the same tradition of blues intonation that Big Mama used. And also, the lyrics were considerably different because Big Mama's, the way the song was written for Big Mama is really about a gigolo. It's a woman complaining about a gigolo. And Elvis couldn't sing that song. I had heard that he knew Big Mama's record and loved it. But it was only after he heard this lounge act do it that it seemed appropriate for a male singer.
You know, I think it was the first time Elvis sang Hound Dog on TV. It was on the Steve Allen Show, and he sang it to a little hound dog. It was very cute.
A basset hound.
A basset hound, okay.
Right.
Did you feel really kind of cheated by that? Here's a song that you wrote that was supposed to be an epithet, you know, about a gigolo, and it ends up with someone as forceful as Elvis making it into, you know, this guy, cute little harmless song on the Steve Allen Show.
We thought it was kind of dopey.
Yeah.
I wasn't offended. I just thought it was silly. That's all.
Songwriters Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller. The drummer on Elvis's recording of Hound Dog was DJ Fontana. He played with Elvis from 1955 to 1969. He's featured on many of Elvis's most successful records and on his 1968 network TV special. I spoke with drummer DJ Fontana in 1987.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl. You're crying all the time. You ain't nothing but a hound dog, girl. Crying all the time.
That has to be one of the famous, most famous drum rolls in history. Did you have that one planned?
No, not really. It's like Paul said, we didn't ever plan anything. We never knew what was going to happen from one second to the other. And we'd go in the studio, just we'd kind of piddle around and find things, you know. And that just one of those things that just accidentally happened. There was no reason for it. I decided to put it in there, and he said, hey, that's great. Do it every time, you know.
I want to ask you about the Ed Sullivan appearance that you and Elvis Presley were on, I guess it was the TV premiere, national TV premiere of Elvis Presley. And we've all heard about how the camera people were told to just shoot him from the waist up.
They said that, but I didn't see any sense in it, and I don't think anybody...
What were you told behind the scenes about that?
They said it was vulgar, his gyrations, but he really didn't do anything. Not comparing to what they're doing now. He was a saint, you know. But the press, you know, they'll write anything that people tell them, and then you got the churches behind you, so you had to just really kind of behave yourself, you know. But Elvis wouldn't have done anything to hurt anybody's feelings or the country or anything else, and he didn't think it was wrong. He really didn't think it was wrong.
You were one of the first groups to perform in front of a lot of screaming people. I think you had a lot of screamers long before the Beatles did.
Yeah, that was quite a few years back.
How did that affect you as a drummer? You must have had to play really loud.
No, not really. He always worked us tight. Everybody was right up against each other. It was hard to hear a lot of times. But I know one time we worked the Cotton Bowl in Dallas. There was about 45,000 people. And back in those days, that's a lot of people. And we really couldn't hear him do a thing. And he took his microphone and went way out to the gate, to the fence. And we were like in the middle of the arena on the 50-yard line. So we was probably 75, 100 foot from the fence. And we couldn't hear a thing. And he couldn't, I'm sure. We only had three little pieces. But we knew by his movements, his hands, his feet, legs, we knew exactly where he was. So we had to watch him awfully close to find out where he was all the time.
So some of those swiveling hips were probably cues to
the
band.
It was cues. When I was 15 years old, I was working strip acts down in Shreveport. So I learned to follow these people. So when he done all his moves, I learned to follow him because then I'd know where he was at.
DJ Fontana was Elvis Presley's drummer from 1955 to 69. I spoke with him in 1987. Coming up, the women who wanted to be the next Elvis. This is Fresh Air. Back in the 1950s, honky-tonkin' was a mostly male sport, and making the music that accompanied it was also the domain of boys and men. But when Elvis came along, there was no holding back the girls. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a survey of the women who tried to reign as queen in the shadow of the king.
Wild, wild young men like to have a good time. Wild, wild young men like to have a good time.
There are some questions that seem to make sense until you ask them. Thinking about the 50s a few weeks ago, somebody asked me, in all innocence, why wasn't there a female Elvis? It would seem to make sense, after all, that if Elvis gave the girls something to scream at, and if screen idols like Marilyn Monroe and Natalie Wood were stirring up the boys' hormones, that a girl rockabilly would be a money-making machine. And it turns out that the answer to the question of a female Elvis is that there was a female Elvis. There were a dozen of them. But you've never heard of them unless you're a real rockabilly fanatic or a country fan. That's where a lot of these young women came from and where the ones who succeeded wound up.
Gonna tell Aunt Mary about Uncle John. He claims he got the misery, but he has a lot of fun. Oh, baby. Yeah, baby. Ooh, baby. They're gonna have some fun tonight. Yeah. Got everything that Uncle John need, oh baby. Yeah,
My favorite was Wanda Jackson from Maud, Oklahoma, who was Capitol Records' entry into the female Elvis sweepstakes and who, as you can hear, was perfectly capable of rocking out. She recorded lots of straight country just in case the rock and roll fad didn't work out, and that's the path she took until a religious conversion more or less ended her recording career. If you can find any of her old records, though, listen to them. Unfortunately, they're very hard to find, and the rockabilly stuff is only in print in France. RCA Records had the original Elvis, so they figured they had the inside track. When pretty teenage Janis Martin showed up in Nashville in 1956, they thought they'd found what they wanted.
They can call you Bill, or even Billy, but you're my sweet William and you drive me silly. Oh, Will, 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 you thrill me to my fingertips. William, 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 yum, 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 I love your tasty lips. William, William.
Janis's first record, Will You William, was a stone flop, and for her next record, they gave her something tested and true.
Hey there, baby, jump over here when you do the ooby-dooby, I just gotta be near.
Of course, this was before the record industry learned that rock and roll fans don't buy multiple versions of a song, and Roy Orbison had already milked Ooby Dooby dry. So the last we hear of Janis is this.
Hey everybody, come on down. The man with the guitar just hit town. Takes off like a rocket, and there he goes, rocking from his head down to his toes.
It was her biggest record, but that wasn't saying much. By 1958, Janis Martin's career at RCA was over. Now, if you know much about the history of rock and roll at this time, you're probably saying, sure, you'd expect big labels like Capitol and RCA to blow it. The small independent labels were where the action was. True. And on Cincinnati's Fraternity label, where Lonnie Mack recorded, we find a female rockabilly whose records are pure gold in collector circles today, Sparkle Moore.
You should be labeled with a skull and a crossbones. Oh, you're a jinx to my soul. Oh, yeah, you should be labeled with a skull and a crossbones. Oh, you're a jinx to my soul. Oh, yeah. Well, you're a man as to wear a batter hoping up a prison because you look like a child driving everyone wild.
But, as you can hear, Skull and Crossbones had what might be called an eccentric vocal. She smoothed it out some for another record, Rock-a-Bop, but it didn't help much.
You take a rock and a bop when it's really neat, and you put them together with the rock-a-bop. Hey, Joe, you're gonna do the rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, you're gonna swing your feet and let a rhythm ever stop, stop. Rock-a-bop, I said rock-a-bop. Rock-a-bop, I said rock-a-bop with me. Come on and rock-a-bop.
Fact was, people weren't buying male rockabillies who sounded like this, although today they're considered the top of the heap. No, the problem with all the female Elvises, including such unlikely personages as Alva Leslie, who combed her short hair back in a fair imitation of the original, but only succeeded in looking like a male impersonator, was that they were girls. And in the 50s, girls were supposed to act in a certain way. It was liberating to see the raw sexuality and frenzied excitement of an Elvis Presley show, but nobody wanted their girlfriend acting that way. And anything less wasn't really rock and roll. It was pop, which is how safer acts like Brenda Lee made it to the charts. In short, nice girls didn't act like that, and bad girls started out with three strikes against them. It would take 20 years for female rock and rollers to get to be an accepted part of the landscape, and by then, Janis Martin, Sparkle Moore, and Wanda Jackson's rocking days had been forgotten.
Ed Ward writes about music and is currently based in Berlin. Coming up, Elvis sung in Latin. This is Fresh Air.
This is Robert Siegel of All Things Considered. Coming up on today's program, we'll be hearing from NPR's Andy Bowers in Bosnia about the latest there and whether the Bosnian Serbs are complying with demands that they withdraw artillery from around Sarajevo. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about the latest efforts and the prospect of greater efforts to come by organized labor to unionize more members of the American workforce. Radio wars, the secret clandestine radio stations that broadcast propaganda during World War II, and Senator Bob Dole criticizes the proposed standards for teaching U.S. history. Those stories coming up next on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
We usually think of Latin as the language of law or philosophy or logic. Well, here's a twist. How about Elvis in Latin? Linguist Jeff Nunberg recently had the opportunity to hear how Elvis sounds in Latin, and he has these thoughts.
Have you ever seen Winnie et le Pooh? A Latin translation of the Pooh stories by a European Bach scholar living in Brazil, published in 1960. It was an international success, the first ever foreign language book on the New York Times bestseller lists. It's still in print. Still, the books always bothered me. Winnie the Pooh is precious enough in English, and translating it into Latin invests that language with entirely the wrong sort of nostalgia. If we're going to have a commercial success in Latin, I'd much prefer that it be the sort of thing I just received in the mail from a Finnish friend who lives in France. This is the work of a man named Dr. Jukka Amont, an amateur singer and professor of literature at the University of Jyväskylä in Finland. As Amont tells the story, he was going through a period of intense depression when Elvis Presley came to him in a dream and told him to record his songs in Latin. Amont went to a colleague from the classics department, and they collaborated on a CD called The Legend Lives Forever, Elvis in Latin. Here, for example, is Amont's version of It's Now or Never, or as it goes in Latin, Nunc hic aut numquam.
Aut numquam me teneas, me salviare hoc venias. Gratiam serius, nunc hic aut numquam, sed ocium.
Amont doesn't try to translate any of Elvis's early rockers, which is probably just as well. I could go to my grave very happily without knowing what You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog sounds like in Latin. Instead, he concentrates on ballads, particularly the Mediterranean sort of material that Elvis started to perform in the 60s. Songs like I Can't Help Falling in Love with You and Impossible. This is the sort of music that appeals to Finnish sensibilities. You knew, of course, that Finland is the tango capital of Europe. Actually, it may have been the music that Elvis liked best, too. When he was growing up, after all, the big vocalists were all those Italian-American singers like Dean Martin, Jerry Vale, and Julius La Rosa. Peter Guralnik reports in his recent biography that Elvis had a big collection of Mario Lanza records when he was still in his teens. And It's Now or Never was just a version of O Sole Mio, which Tony Martin had a hit with in 1950 under the title There's No Tomorrow. I suppose you could argue that the whole rock and roll period of the late 50s was only a digression for Elvis on the way to realizing his real ambition of becoming an Italian lounge singer. In any case, this sort of material works fine in Latin if you make allowances for Amon's slightly karaoke renditions. Here's the Latin version of Surrender, which of course was just an English version of the Italian song Come Back to Sorrento.
Ardet corden novus furo in te quoque flammam esse scio cum te passio mihi queso des amore.
Of course, it shouldn't be surprising that a song that was originally written in Italian or French works well in Latin. And yet, it takes you back a bit. We don't think of Latin as sounding so, well, so Latin. People always talk about Latin as this enormously dignified language, the language of law and philosophy, the language of logic and precision, the perfect instrument for inculcating mental discipline into generations of schoolboys before we all went soft and permissive. We think of it as a language with lots of genders but no sex. You look at the rows of Roman busts in the Louvre or the Villa Borghese, it doesn't occur to you that these people even had pelvises. But of course, that's a conception of Latin that has less to do with Catullus than with Brideshead Revisited, all those upper-class Englishmen sloshing their way around their country houses reciting Latin tags to their teddy bears. That's why Vinae ille puh was such a great success, I suppose. It turns Latin into a dialect of Edwardian English. Only, we should bear in mind that if the Latin poets were alive, they'd be much bigger fans of Elvis than of A.A. Milne. And who knows, maybe vice versa as well. You wonder why this CD doesn't include a Latin version of Elvis's great tribute to Virgil, Aeneid Your Love Tonight.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Nancy Updike. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Train arrived, 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby and gone. Train, train, coming round, round the bend. Train, train.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Eric Lomax was a POW held by the Japanese during World War II. He never quite recovered from the interrogations and torture. Recently, he found the man who interrogated him. On the next Fresh Air, Eric Lomax tells us why he forgave his interrogator. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.